talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at one of the most dramatic episodes of the Second World War, Operation Dynamo, the incredible evacuation of Allied forces from Dunkirk in 1940, when almost 340,000 soldiers were rescued from the beaches in a daring operation that changed the course of history. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Launched 85 years ago in May 1940, Operation Dynamo was the daring evacuation of Allied troops from Dunkirk in France as German forces encircled them. Naval vessels and a flotilla of civilian little ships crossed the channel under constant attack, rescuing soldiers trapped on the beaches. Though born out of a military defeat, the operation became a symbol of resilience and unity. It galvanised British morale and it allowed Britain to fight on and ultimately to win. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore what happened at Dunkirk and the daring operation to rescue the stranded troops. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Eunan O'Halpin is Emeritus Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin, whose work on intelligence neutrality and Irish security during the Second World War has shed new light on Ireland's delicate position during this time. And his books include Spying on Ireland, British Intelligence and Irish Neutrality During the Second World War. Dr. David Jordan is Senior Lecturer in Defence Studies at King's College London and Co-Director of the Freeman Air and Space Institute, and he's an expert on the role of air power and defence strategy, and he has walked the very beaches of Dunkirk while leading military staff rides, and he's the co-author of Understanding Modern Warfare. Professor Jonathan Fennell is Professor of the History of War and Society at King's College London and is the President of the Second World War Research Group. And his books include the award-winning Fighting the People's War, The British and Commonwealth Armies and the Second World War. And he's currently working on a trilogy of books about the causes, conduct and consequences of the Second World War. Well, you're all very welcome. And Eunan, I might begin with you with a big, broad question about Dunkirk and its significance. How important was it at the time and what was its later significance?
Well, it was enormously important at the time. It appeared to mark the end of the Anglo-French alliance, which had been there since 1914. What came in play was the French Empire and France overseas and what would happen there. It precipitated an extraordinary proposal from Churchill, who obviously hadn't heard of Brexit, of an Anglo-French union. It precipitated Churchill, amongst other things, to appeal to Ireland to join the war in return for a vague promise of Irish unity post-war. And it appeared to be the nadir of Britain's fortunes. Many people, including in Ireland, felt that Britain had finally been dished, that she would have to surrender, and that there would be a new post-war world to be constructed by Germany. It's worth noting in relation to Ireland, on the 29th of May, Churchill is told by his sort of overlord in relation to internal security that the IRA are going to have a rising conjunction with the Germans, that the Irish Defence Forces are pitifully weak, and that if something doesn't happen soon, Britain may have to, and Britain does prepare to move troops into Southern Ireland, particularly to secure airfields, whether or not the Irish like it. So it's a momentous consequence for Ireland. I know Ireland is only a tiny part of the bigger picture.
And Winston Churchill is the new British Prime Minister in May 1940. He has just come to power.
He has just come to power. He's replaced Neville Chamberlain, who ironically, you could argue, the reason Britain wins the Battle of Britain, the air battle, In the autumn of 1940 is because when Chamberlain was at the Treasury and later as Prime Minister, that he supported the Treasury's primarily argument that what the RAF needed above all was modern fighter aircraft and what became radar, rather than producing thousands of semi-obsolete bombers, which is what the RAF High Command mainly wanted.
And is Dunkirk a humiliation, or is it a kind of a defeat or an embarrassment, a retreat that becomes a victory in the way it's presented, in the way the spirit of Dunkirk becomes an important part of the British story of resistance and spirit during the Second World War? What exactly is it?
Well, I think it's all of those things. It's a culmination of a catastrophic defeat for the British, and above all for France and the French nation. It's also becomes, because of Churchill's particular genius for rallying people, it becomes in a sense a demonstration that out of defeat we can ultimately resist, and ultimately we can find victory.
Jonathan, what went wrong for France and what went wrong for the Allies in May 1940? The scale of the collapse and the speed of the collapse really is quite extraordinary.
I mean, France survived 14 to 18, siege warfare on the Western Front, and ultimately succeeded. And in a matter of weeks in 1940, France collapses. We have to go back to the 10th of May 1940 when the campaign begins. And when we look at force-to-force ratios, really, France and Britain and the Low Countries should have prevailed. German historians have talked about the German plan as having a 1 in 100 chance of success. But they strike with all their might at a weak point in the Allied line around the city of Sedan, if listeners can kind of picture where that is. And it lay on a hinge between the fixed right wing of the French army, which is the Maginot Line, and the rest of the army towards the Channel coast that was supposed to advance into Belgium when the Germans attacked, the idea being that France didn't want to fight a Second World War in its old territory. It didn't want its northern provinces to be eaten up and destroyed again. And when the German forces attack Sedan, they break through. And there's huge debate over what went wrong. Some say it was a military defeat, bad military decisions by weak commanders and weak politicians. Or was it a moral collapse of the French state? Well, for sure, we know that around 20,000 French soldiers abandoned their positions in the Sedan sector during those critical days of May 1940. And the Germans break through and they start to launch this astonishingly quick and aggressive sickle cut west towards the Channel coast. Everything now depended on a French counterattack, right? I mean, the history of the Second World War shows that panzers driving on their own are very vulnerable to attack, but the French are unable to coordinate a really strong counterattack. They launch local counterattacks, and the tension starts to mount. On the 17th of May, Renault, the prime minister, removes Gamelin, the supreme commander, and replaces him with Weygand, who was one of the heroes from the First World War, who still had thousands of tanks at his 1,200 tanks under his control, and he hoped to launch a counterattack to reestablish the position. So by 23 May, things are starting to unravel, okay? The BEF, so the British Expeditionary Force, the British proportion of the Allied armies, had fallen back to their old frontier positions where they'd started the campaign before the advance into the lowlands. They're preparing to counterattack, but the Germans break through their lines. The Belgians start to fall back, and they're left in a really, really difficult position. And so Gort, who's the commander, has to make a call. And I guess we could all try and reimagine the kind of pressure he was under. He'd been ordered by Weygand to launch the counterattack, but in his view, it looked destined to fail. So the prospects of a more general breakout seem impossible. So at 6 o'clock on the 25th of May, Gort decides to cancel preparations for this counterattack to recover the position, and he orders his divisions to fill the gap left by the Belgians and to start thinking about retreating to the coast. And it's the following evening, the 26th of May, that the British government gave its orders for the commencement of Operation Dynamo and the evacuation of the army from Dunkirk.
And Jonathan, how is it that, is Dunkirk the natural point that they would have ended up in this during this retreat?
So as the situation deteriorates, the options get smaller and smaller and smaller, and it really is at this stage the last viable option to get many, many British soldiers off the continent. And you've got to think the Admiralty back in Britain thinks at best you can get 40,000 of the 400 British troops off the beaches and back to the United Kingdom, given the scale of the crisis.
And Jonathan, this is then where Operation Dynamo comes into play, and the decision to rescue as many troops as possible rather than just this 40,000. So what's the rationale, and I suppose what's the moral imperative behind all of this?
If Britain loses its major field army, it is unable to continue the fight, really. The level of tension is extraordinary, and so Britain has to find a way to rescue its army. The RAF launches close to 5,000 sorties from its bases in southern England to try and protect the evacuation of troops. I mean, if you think about it, all those troops in a very, very small area is a sitting duck for the Luftwaffe. And the Luftwaffe does have a field day. It knocks out the piers and jetties. The men were then forced, kind of famously right, to be evacuated over the beach, indeed via the small boats that were ferried across the channel to support that process. And they were evacuated over the two breakwaters, the famous moles that shielded the harbour from the channel storm. So every available ship that Bertram Ramsay, the commander of the evacuation, could get his hands on were sent to Dunkirk. They were taking off the convoys. They were moved from Norway, where the campaign has just about ended, down to the channel to try and rescue the British army. So yes, without this effort, things are looking very, very bleak in London.
And including all of these little ships that were used for the purpose as well. And it really seems an extraordinary coming together of civilians and members of the public as well as the military to try and save as many people as possible.
Well, we can think about people's war, can't we? These are states at war against each other, not just armies. I mean, the little ships were made up of retired Navy officers, fishermen, yachtsmen, who were basically rounded up and sent across the channel. The strength of the nation here, and I think it's very important to stress the strength of the British nation was also based on the strength of an empire, was absolutely vital. And so this is a moment where, in spite of decades of difficulty, the 1930s, with all their economic contestation, the British nation does broadly pull together in this crisis.
And Jonathan, worst case scenario, if the evacuation at Dunkirk hadn't been successful, what would have that meant for the Second World War? Would Britain have been able to continue in the conflict, or would it have been inevitable that Britain was going to have to either surrender or eventually be defeated?
Wow, what a question. Well, Patrick, okay, so an historian never uses the word inevitable, right? And it's almost impossible to know how it would have played out. So during a small period during May, there were a number of cabinet meetings where discussions were made over whether Britain should fight on, given the crisis that was unfolding. And ultimately, the decision very powerfully was, of course, Britain should fight on. And I would imagine that even if the British Army had been lost on the fields of France, Britain would have fought on from empire. But it would have been an awfully difficult situation and very hard even from 85 years on to imagine how they would have pulled it off.
So, David, you've actually walked the very beaches on Dunkirk while leading these military staff rides. Tell us about the terrain. Tell us about, your view, your insight into it and what it must have been like back then in 1940.
It's quite remarkable that you get over 350,000 British personnel out of France in 1940. Dunkirk is under air attack, as Jonathan has mentioned, and the place is covered with smoke from targets that have been struck, and you've just got the moles. So there are people who are having to wade out into the water, chest high. There are ships all over the place. There's wreckage because obviously people are just abandoning equipment. They can't take stuff. They're having to leave heavy equipment. A lot of small arms get lost as well because obviously people wading out are not going to want to be weighed down with kit. So it must have been quite appalling to be there. And you've also got the scene, of course, that there's not the ability to load multiple boats simultaneously, multiple ships. So you've got some alongside the mole.
So just remind our listeners about the mole. People who have seen the Christopher Nolan film will be familiar with it. So this is the long, is it wooden and concrete breakwater pier at the harbour?
Yeah, it's a pier that is designed for many things, but the evacuation of tens of thousands of personnel might not be. Do forgive me if you heard a loud bang in the background. I'm speaking from my office at the Defence Academy, and sometimes they train explosive ordnance disposal people here. So any loud bangs like that to provide suitable atmosphere for Dunkirk, admittedly, will be coming from that. But the mole is as you say, a very long, narrow construction. It's not designed for evacuating people, and of course they're under fire as well. Now the Luftwaffe is attacking them. They're not under naval bombardment, but it's not the ideal place to take people off. So you have people wading out from the beaches, trying desperately to get aboard ship so they can be removed to the safety of England.
And David, tell me about the role that air power played in Operation Dynamo, because there were criticisms of the RAF. There was a criticism that they were absent during it. And how fair is that criticism?
It's not very fair at all, to be honest, but there you can understand why the troops on the beaches, why the Royal Navy think this. For two reasons. First of all, the Royal Air Force isn't big enough to provide constant air cover over Dunkirk. There's just no way of doing it. They don't have sufficient squadrons, and Hugh Dowding, the Air Office Commanding in Chief of Fighter Command, is desperately worried that he will fritter away his fighter forces that he needs for the to deal with the assault on Britain that he knows will come. He's worried that he'll run out of forces, and he's already, of course, intervened by this stage to prevent Churchill and the War Cabinet from sending more fighters to support the French. The French have been desperate for more fighter aircraft, and they just don't get them. Dowding says that if we send them and France falls, there'll be what he calls a completely irredeemable defeat of the United Kingdom. So they're sending out small, relatively small packages of fighter aircraft from bases in the south of England to spend as much time as they can covering the beaches. But one of the other things they're trying to do is they're trying to stop the Luftwaffe from getting to the beaches to bomb them in the first place. And we therefore see two problems. First of all, if you're somebody on the beach, on the mole, waiting to be evacuated, you might see the occasional fighter aircraft, British fighter aircraft. The reason you don't is because they're operating at depth, trying to stop the Germans from getting through to the beaches. And they have a reasonably decent amount of success in doing this. The problem is there are insufficient British aircraft to stop all the Luftwaffe aircraft from getting through. And the second problem is because there's so few of them, they can only patrol over France for a relatively limited period of time and can't be replaced on station because their endurance is relatively low. It's one of the crippling, well, not crippling, but major elements for both the Spitfire and the Hurricane, the two main RAF fighters. The reason you don't see Spitfires over Berlin in 1944-45 escorting American bombers is simply because of the fact they never get the range in the Spitfire. In the Mark I and Mark II Spitfires of 1940, they can spend a very short period of time over the beaches. And while Tom Hardy's Spitfire in the film demonstrates a gliding capability that no Spitfire ever actually had, you don't want to be running out of fuel halfway above the channel and having to try to glide back home. So they have a limited time on station. And the further problem is that they don't have enough, as I say, to provide constant patrols. End result is there are periods of the day when there is no air cover because there is physically none available to provide, as the fighter squadrons are rearming and regrouping and ready to go out again. So the end result of this is the Army and Navy, and I think it's understandable why they think this, they think, well, the Air Force hasn't bothered turning up. And the Air Force has, and it suffers pretty heavy losses. And if I can sort of bring in another cultural reference, in The Great Escape, the character that Richard Attenborough plays, which is based on Roger Bushell of 92 Squadron, Bushell is shot down and lost during the Battle of France. So you have some members of the RAF who are experienced members as well, who are shot down or have to force land, who are taken prisoner in 1940 and who don't get back until 1945. And this, of course, the RAF is quite resentful of the fact that they've suffered these casualties and they've put in all this effort, only to be accused of having, frankly, not bothered to turn up. And it is, to be fair, something that Churchill is worried about, and he seeks to create a different narrative and says, you know, you need to remember that Dunkirk couldn't have happened, would have been much more difficult had it not been for the work of the RAF unseen by the troops on the ground. Don't forget also that the RAF is covering the other evacuation operations as best it can, Operation Aerial and Operation Cycle out of Le Havre. And this means their resources are stretched incredibly thin. So it's absence, not by intention or lack of willing, it's absence by force of circumstance.
And David, do you think the Germans made mistakes on their side, that maybe they underestimated the resilience of the evacuation and that the Luftwaffe perhaps believed that they had an air superiority too early and then were caught by surprise by what was happening?
I think the Luftwaffe's biggest problem, and it speaks to your wider question of complacency, is the fact that they're led by Hermann Göring. And Göring is not an air strategist. Yes, he's been a fighter pilot in the First World War, but without, you know, wishing to be too too flippant, it'll sound it, he's more interested in consuming almost industrial quantities of painkillers as a result of injuries from the First World War and looting French artwork. And he's also got a keen interest in keeping on side with Hitler. So he thinks that the Luftwaffe, if it will deliver the victory that Hitler wants, that this will stand him personally in good stead, as well as the service that he leads. So he convinces Hitler that he needs to, that he can rely on the Luftwaffe. But there's also, of course, this other factor, which is that we ignore the fact that the German forces have, you know, they've had to fight their way. They haven't just rolled all the way easily to the evacuation beaches at Dunkirk. There's this sort of image that everything collapses without too much fighting. The Germans have it easy. They don't. So they've suffered losses, and they actually get to the stage where they do need to take what would be termed an operational pause to be able to regroup and to launch a sort of a final potential assault on the beach. And this leads to the controversial halt order in part. But they're over-optimistic. It's a case, well, the British are done for. And surely that they will either roll their army up and they won't get off the beaches. And even if they do manage to get people away, and of course the Germans quite rightly like the initial, you know, look at it as does the Royal Navy and say we can't get that many people off, and that's the view they take. So yes, there is a certain amount of complacency. There's complacency induced by Hitler, but there's also force of circumstance again, where they need to take a pause to regroup and get ready for another assault. And there's obviously the belief that this is pretty much endgame, because how on earth are the British going to evacuate the British Expeditionary Force? And the answer, they think, is actually not very many. It's a matter of time. Surely Churchill will come to his senses. And of course, as they discover, Churchill doesn't, in inverted commas, come to his senses. He turns around and says, right, we fight on. And Dunkirk is inherent in part of the decision to do that. It's a case of, yes, we can do this. Now we've evacuated. So complacency plays a part, certainly, but also a realistic appreciation, or what appeared to be a realistic appreciation of the situation, I think, leads to the Germans saying, well, actually, we need to stop momentarily. There's the injection of Göring's massive over expectation of what air power can deliver. But they assume the war in the West is as good as over, and then they can stop and turn their attention to the Soviet Union, which is what Hitler really wants to do. And of course, it doesn't play out like that, largely because of the forces that are evacuated, and Britain can fight on.
Jonathan, why do you think that controversial halt order was given? Was it a case of Hitler and the German high command thinking that perhaps a deal with Britain was possible, or were they concerned about their supply lines and being overstretched, or did they just have too much faith in the Luftwaffe?
What I would add to David's is also a sense of fear, which might seem strange seeing as they were riding high at the time. Minds went back to 1914 and the French miracle of the Marne. It had looked then like the Germans were about to achieve rapid operational and even strategic level victory, and it had not played out. And there is a sense, I think, in the German literature, at least now, that suggests that the pause is there because there's just a moment of moral panic. Do we push on? And again, I mean, the gambler can think, do you now put everything in the pot for total victory? Or do you hold back just a little just to make sure that something doesn't go wrong? And they just hold, they pause. maybe they lose confidence just for a few days. And in a campaign where the margins are so tight, that ultimately creates the conditions which allows the British Army to escape. The escape of the British Army allows the conditions for the British Empire to continue fighting on. The continuation of the British Empire fighting in the war eventually creates the conditions for the United States and Soviet Union to become part of this global conflict. So small things lead to big outcomes.
Very good. Well, tonight we are talking about Operation Dynamo and the evacuation of those troops from Dunkirk 85 years ago. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be finding out about the success of the operation and the fall of France. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the evacuation from Dunkirk 85 years ago and Operation Dynamo. I'm rejoined by Professor Eunan O'Halpin, Emeritus Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. David Jordan, Senior Lecturer in Defence Studies at King's College London and Co-Director of the Freeman Air and Space Institute, and Professor Jonathan Fennell, Professor of the History of War and Society at King's College London and President of the Second World War Research Group. Eunan, talk to me about, I suppose, the impact or the effect of Irish neutrality. Did it have an influence on shaping the operation during Operation Dynamo, or did these complications in terms of logistics and intelligence really come later?
Well, I think it's clear that while Dunkirk is going on, that's the point at which Churchill decides, A, to tell the Irish they're going to be invaded shortly by the Germans, and B, to push them towards some kind of sort of Anglo-Irish union almost, and certainly a North-South hypothetical post-war union. So Ireland is part of the picture because obviously it's part of the British Isles. Now, whether in strategic terms, Churchill after the war writes about Irish neutrality in terms of the, you know, the sentinels guarding the Atlantic and the forts that were given up in 1938, in practice, I would have thought the most important elements of Ireland for Britain, other than personnel, which they continued to get because there was effectively no restriction on Irish men and women joining the war, was airfields and so on for Atlantic defence. And that wasn't really part of the discussion in May, June 1940. They were thinking about the existing Irish airfields, such as they were, in terms of taking them over to prevent the Germans taking them over through parachute attacks and so on. So they were thinking short term, not long term. And certainly in Ireland, there was really, other than the government's point of view, consternation at the sudden British Anglo-French collapse, if you like. There certainly wasn't any thinking, this is a war which Britain is losing and therefore we must now join. On the contrary, let's stay out of it. And of course, the IRA and many Irish people were cheering, including all my grandparents, were cheering for Hitler as Republicans rather than taking a sort of wider view of the nature of the Nazi regime and so on. John Bull, Dan Breen is an extreme example of this, the famous gunman. John Bull was finally getting the beating that he deserved.
So people in Ireland would have been looking at this and thinking, France is about to fall, and it does fall in June. It's only a matter of time before Britain falls as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was no concept that America, for example, was going to come and save Ireland. The Irish state didn't believe that Uncle Sam was going to rescue them.
And, you know, I've always thought that Churchill was at his very best in this period, you know, May 1940 to maybe to the end of the year, that this was his greatest period of leadership. And is there a genius there in the way he is able to speak to the public and convince them that this evacuation is a great triumph of the British military, and it's the British spirit, it's the Dunkirk spirit, and that it could have been presented in a very different way under a different leader, and that people might have despaired and thought, okay, we survived to fight another day, but we're probably going to lose on that other day, and that instead it almost galvanizes the public and rejuvenates and re-energizes the war effort.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is where I think Churchill's personal capacity for leadership and for communication, not only with his fighting men and so on, but with the wider public, comes into it. Because Britain had just had a humiliation with the Norwegian campaign. We shouldn't forget that, where another neutral is invaded by Germany and Britain and France attempt to intervene. It's a complete dog's dinner. When Chamberlain goes, Churchill comes in. His what he can offer the British people is resolved not to be beaten, whatever the defeats on land, sea, or air. This is Churchill's card, this is what he pushes from the word go. And I think absolutely, I think the idea of him is a great strategy. Donald Trump apparently has put Churchill back in the Oval Office. But Churchill, I do not believe, was a great strategist. In fact, an Irishman, a man of Irish origin, Sir Alan Brooke, who becomes chief of the Imperial General Staff in 1941, if you read his diaries, and Brooke is generally regarded as highly competent, he spends most of his time, while he absolutely reveres Churchill in many ways, but he spends most of his time trying to stop Churchill interfering with what he regards as military matters and defence matters, because Churchill is forever, as it were, moving toys across the charts and saying, why do we do this? And he's always pressing for action. And some of the time it's, I think, I don't know, my colleagues would know more about it, but some of the times it's a calamity.
Jonathan, you're currently working on this new trilogy of books about the causes, conduct and consequences of the Second World War, and they're going to be published over, I think, the next 5-6 years. And I'm wondering, are you investigating Churchill's leadership during this time? And would you agree with Yunan that sometimes he was at his best when he was making the great speeches and when he wasn't trying to directly influence the military policy?
Yeah, I think Yunan's fair enough on that. I mean, he was a great storyteller, right? I mean, you can, even reading his stuff, you know, decades on, he writes beautifully, he captures the imagination. And in many ways, after a defeat like Dunkirk and the Battle of France, you needed a new story to bring the nation together. And he did manage that. Remember, also, he brings the Labour Party into government in this critical phase, which gives him the potential at least to tell a story of a united war effort. But to come to Yunan's point, I mean, okay, Britain enters the war explicitly to protect Polish sovereignty. By 1945, Poland isn't sovereign. It enters the war really to maintain the empire and British prestige and power. And by 1945, the British Empire is holed below the waterline. So, yeah, I think you can, you know, with some justification, be critical of the way Britain navigates the war. At the same time, the Allies are victorious. And that was impossible without Britain standing in 1940 and continuing the fight. Britain could have decided to capitulate like France, and we might still be living with the consequences if that had played out. So I think, you know, a balanced assessment is called for. Yes, it's ultimately destructive for the British Empire, but especially in this period, this is probably as good as it gets. Great tenacity and holds on.
And Jonathan, you mentioned the capitulation of France. France, of course, falls soon after that. After this, what are the strategic consequences of the fall of France?
I mean, it's absolutely immense. So within, you know, the Italians join the war effort, this increases, this kind of escalates this conflict into truly global terms. Britain now has to deal with the Italian Navy in the Mediterranean just to add more problems. I mean, for the United States, it kind of wakes them out of their slumber. It's very clear all of a sudden that maybe they can't rely on the Royal Navy to protect the Atlantic. They can't rely on the French army, the great French army, to keep the Germans at bay. And so there's a massive increase in American defense spending after the fall of France. It awakens the slumbering American economic potential, and arguably is the fulcrum of the 20th century, right? It brings America alive as a potential superpower. And it suddenly means that Germany has access to the economic resources of most of Western Europe, which makes it a autarkic economic superpower and gives it the potential now, arguably, to fight a long war against the rest of the world and to reorder global power. So the strategic consequences are absolutely immense.
And how did the German High Command view it? Did they celebrate the fall of France and think now that their forces were nearly invincible? Or was there a kind of a doubt there that perhaps they'd missed this great opportunity to try and knock Britain out as well?
I think there's enormous hope. It's amazing. I mean, the German government tried to keep an eye on, say, public morale, and they had these very sophisticated tools for assessing public sentiment. And you can read these reports of how the German public was, you know, as you might imagine, cock-a-hoop and delighted with the outcome of the Battle of France. And I think more generally, that is the assessment that was made across the High Command. And there was an expectation, as I think David kind of pointed to earlier, that Britain would come to terms. And the public think that the terms that Hitler offers Britain in this period are very reasonable and can't quite understand why Britain doesn't fold. And so in many ways, the German public sees Britain's decision to fight on as unreasonable. The war has been foisted upon Germany rather than Germany foisting the war upon the world. Can't they see reason is the viewpoint. And ultimately, Britain's decision to fight on creates so many problems for Germany. And the decision is ultimately made that the only way to deal with Britain is to actually get a greater access to resources in the East and attack the Soviet Union. So the attack on the Soviet Union can be linked to ideological reasons, but also to the sheer fact that Britain fights on, requiring Germany to get access to ever greater resources to ultimately defeat it, and in due course, the United States as well.
And Jonathan, why do you think the French did decide to seek an armistice and not fight on, perhaps continue the fight from abroad? I know they'd lost their military capacity. Much of the army was overwhelmed. I know there was a psychological factor, perhaps with the trauma from the First World War. But I'm wondering why there wasn't a stronger political will when you look at people like Marshal Pétain, who, you know, was the line of Verdun from the First World War. And I remember when we did a show on Verdun a few years ago and, you know, his heroism there and the quote attributed to him, I think someone else said it, "They shall not pass." And instead, then in 1940, they decide they will surrender.
It's one of the great historical conundrums, isn't it? And it comes back to that kind of maybe split between, is the fall of France a battle loss, just one simple military mistake, or is it something bigger than that? Is it a moral collapse? And you know, historians have argued and will continue to argue over that. For me, you know, a balanced approach is required. I probably lean towards a moral collapse to a greater extent. I mean, let's just look at some of the interesting kind of statistics. So between the rise of Hitler and the Great Crisis of 1940, France had experienced 34 separate governments, 9 different premiers and 7 foreign ministers. Britain during the same period had experienced 3 prime ministers, and of course, Germany, Italy and the Soviet Union had not changed. If we look at the number of parliamentary questions during these years that were concerned with foreign policy issues, that's only 1% of them. So France was looked inwards at its own divisions. There was violence in the streets in 1934, and it looked like a coup was going to play out. And so in many ways, the French government, after the collapse of the army, becomes more concerned with the enemy within than the enemy without. They think that fighting on is to the benefit of the communists. It's the benefit of Stalin more than it's to the benefit of France. And so, you know, Union talked about the kind of extraordinary offer that Churchill made to France to fight on as part of a Franco-British Union, but the cabinet just says no, and this will just render them a dominion, a British dominion. And the British have already been shown to be untrustworthy. They didn't send all their planes to France. They abandoned us, France, at the moment of our greatest need. And so on the 17th of June, Pétain broadcasts to the French nation that resistance would cease. And so maybe again, you know, we can look back historically to how this decision is shaped by other events. Maybe it was the specter of the Commune in 1871, when an uprising had followed defeat in the Franco-Prussian War that had led to 20,000 deaths in Paris. They just decided no. And in many ways, it's a revolutionary moment, right? So Pétain sees defeat as his opportunity to rewire France politically. All this political and social division of the 1930s, now he gets his chance to be in charge and to make France into the country he wants. So it's a revolutionary moment brought around by military defeat.
And David, does the RAF learn important lessons from Dunkirk? Because it's about to face into the Battle of Britain, Germany's Operation Sea Lion to attempt to invade. You've got the Blitz coming a few months later. That this is the crucial period for the RAF. And have they been able to gain some important insights into strategy and tactics from what happened at Dunkirk?
To a degree, yes, but the Air Force in 1940 has been pretty much configured to fight the Battle of Britain. There is a bit of a myth about the RAF in the interwar period that it spends all its money on trying to build a bomber force. But in fact, as historians like John Ferris have demonstrated, most of the money goes into building the first, what's known as an integrated air defence system. So Fighter Command, when it's established in 1936, is in the vanguard of working out how you do the air defence of the United Kingdom. And the way in which that system is laid down arguably it slightly constrains what the RAF attempts to do over Dunkirk, because as I've hinted at already, Dowding is really concerned as the commander-in-chief of Fighter Command that he'll fritter away all these fighter aircraft that he needs to conduct the plan to defend the UK. They'll all go in France. Now, the loss of France does have a profound effect in that number 11 group becomes the group that has to fight the battle that's in the south of England. The original plan had been the number 12 group, which is headquartered around Duxford in Cambridgeshire. That would bear the brunt of the German offensive, which would be coming over the North Sea. And anything that came, obviously, to the south would be engaged by the French Air Force. So the Battle of Britain, in essence, is it's the operational test for the United Kingdom's air defence system that he spent quite some time building up, even in the what so-called locust years of the 20s. They've been spending money on doing this. So the immediate effect is actually to fight the Battle of Britain. And indeed, the chiefs of staff, they have a document which they circulate to the War Cabinet called British Strategy in a Certain Eventuality. And that certain eventuality is the fall of France. They do this while the fighting's still going on, obviously. Now, I've always had this sort of slight wonderment as to whether this is them being diplomatic and not daring to use the phrase defeat of France, or whether they've concluded that the eventuality of France falling is a certainty. It's not entirely clear from the language. But they're very confident. They say, as long as we can keep the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force in being, we'll be okay. Hitler will not be able to invade. We'll smash the invasion force. And they're quite right. The Royal Navy would have smashed the invasion force had the Germans tried to come across. It just wasn't a credible idea. What the Air Force does, though, and this is actually where some experimentation known as the One Woodall experiments between an army officer and an RAF group captain conducted in Northern Ireland, they say one of the things that didn't work was air support. And they develop air support for the, or try to develop air support between the UK's air assets and the British Army. And they conduct a number of experiments where they, in fact, just relearn the lessons they'd learned between 1914 and 1918 about how air and land power integrated. And indeed, the other lesson that comes out at this point, which might be of interest, former member of the Irish Air Corps, a chap by the name of Michael O'Malley, did his PhD on the Air Corps, and his research dug out a number of state documents that hadn't been revealed. And it's also fairly clear from Michael's research that the RAF, one of the other lessons is, well, actually, what happens if Hitler chooses to invade Ireland? And very, very low-key but important liaison taking place while the battle, in fact, while the evacuation from Dunkirk is taking place between the Irish Air Corps and the Royal Air Force. And in fact, they come to a conclusion where that they meet at Baldonnel on 14th of June, and they talk about the possibility of the RAF providing air support, building upon some of the lessons from France, for the Irish Army should there be a German invasion of the Republic of Ireland. And there's a lot of this low-level liaison going on, because that's the other thing we need to bear in mind, I think, that the Air Force is not only, although its main focus, obviously, is the Battle of Britain. It's also, what have we learned? Well, one of the things is we haven't got time to learn the lessons immediately. We've got to fend off this German threat. But the big thing is about the proper integration of air and land power. And they're not just thinking about doing that, as I say, with the British Army. The evidence that Michael O'Malley uncovered suggests that they're also thinking about how do we do it with our neighbours in Ireland, because obviously a German invasion of the Republic is bad news for the UK as well. So there's a lot of things going on simultaneously, and the lessons learned really start to come in and kick in from 1941. And even then, they're frequently learned in operational theatres of war rather than by people sitting down and poring over what should we do next and what should we learn in London. It's done in places like North Africa and East Africa, where they put together the air support mechanisms that lead to the really potent air support that's provided ultimately in Normandy in 1944. And prior to that, North Africa and Italy is where air support is really successful too. So it's a bit of a mixed picture. They're dealing with the immediacy, first of all, and then the big lesson they learn or relearn is the importance of air support.
Well, tonight we are talking about the evacuation of the Allied troops from Dunkirk in 1940, 85 years ago. And when we come back, we'll be assessing the scale of the Allied achievement at Dunkirk. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we are talking about Dunkirk and Operation Dynamo on this, its 85th anniversary. I'm rejoined by Professor Eunan O'Halpin, Emeritus Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. David Jordan, Senior Lecturer in Defence Studies at King's College London and Co-Director of the Freeman Air and Space Institute, and Professor Jonathan Fennell, Professor of the History of War and Society at King's College London and the President of the Second World War Research Group. Jonathan, let's just try and assess the scale of the Allied achievements, because an estimated 338,000 troops were evacuated. I think one third of those were French. So this was hugely significant in terms of those British troops, but I suppose also in terms of the French soldiers who were rescued and evacuated.
Absolutely. And enormously important politically at this stage too, where Churchill is desperately trying to get the French to continue fighting. And not all of those French soldiers end up choosing to continue the fight. Many of them go back home afterwards. The costs are extraordinary. I mean, we should clearly kind of recognize the Royal Navy and the losses that they experienced of nearly, 848 vessels of all descriptions that were involved in the operation. About 20% were sunk, were lost, and nearly half were damaged. So the scale is extraordinary. They get off basically a field army from the fields of France, and they lose a very, very significant part of the fleet.
And Eunan, you also see troops being rescued from other ports.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to realize Dunkirk is the main focus, but all along the French Atlantic coast, where it's possible to do so, soldiers and civilians get out by boat, whether not with the same sort of collective drive that there was in relation to Dunkirk. And it continues, people trickling out. A friend of mine, Tony Brooks, who was a civilian, an Englishman, grew up largely in France and Switzerland. He gets out in as late as, I think, March 1941 by walking over the Pyrenees, and he ends up being sent back into France a year and a half later as an SOE agent. So there's more fluidity, if you like, than you might think, even after France signs the armistice and so on.
So, Jonathan, how do you think we should assess the legacy of Dunkirk on this, the 85th anniversary? Is it an extraordinary, I don't want to use the word victory, but an extraordinary rescue mission in the face of what could have been a crushing defeat? Is it something that was able to inspire, it was a rescue that became a myth, that became part of the legend of Britain during the Second World War?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good overview. I mean, Churchill himself was willing to say, this is not what victory is made of. This is a disaster. But he was able to tell a story. And in many ways, when we think of strategy, when we think of the complexity of fighting a war, it's very hard to control anything. And kind of modern assessments of strategy talk about telling stories. The best we can do, given we can hardly control events, is to tell a story about what happened and hope that motivates and enthuses people to do their best. And Churchill told an astonishing story of greatness in face of adversity. And it's an amazing, I think, lesson to all of us and to kids about never giving in. Even when everything looks as dark as it can look, and it could never look as bad as this, right? This is defeat on a scale that we cannot even imagine in the 21st century. They didn't give in, and they kept going. And the result was that ultimately democracy did survive. And we did have, broadly, with complexities, peace in Europe for the best part of a century. So yeah, it's an extraordinary historical event.
Yeah, I think that's a very important message as well. And David, I might give you the final word. The legacy of Dunkirk, 85 years on, it had a huge impact on the course of the Second World War. It's something that continues to inspire and influence. And you see that in the way it has inspired storytellers, writers, filmmakers, including Christopher Nolan with Dunkirk a few years ago. And it is an important part of the story of the Second World War.
Yeah, undoubtedly. It's, as has been said, the continuation of the Second World War might not have been possible without the Dunkirk evacuation. The absolute humiliation of the UK that could have ensued, the apparent willingness to abandon France, which is still, as we've said, something that resonates within certain French circle, government circles during the Second World War, and indeed beyond that, is offset to an extent by the evacuation of French troops. And we should remember as well that they're even at one point thinking about evacuating troops, reforming them, and sending them back as a second British Expeditionary Force. That doesn't happen, of course. But what you get is the ability that Jonathan's alluded to of Churchill's speech making to use it for inspiration. And of course, he uses Dunkirk as the foundation for "we must fight on." And he says, you know, Hitler knows he must break us in this island or lose the war. And he comes out with that. He comes out with that line saying that, you know, if Britain fails, he's saying like the whole world, including the United States, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. Now, of course, Churchill is obviously doing this for rhetorical effect, but he's not far wrong. Churchill's right in terms of saying that, you know, Hitler has to knock Britain out of the war. And had Dunkirk not occurred and the other evacuations, had Britain not demonstrated to itself as much as to the wider world a willingness to fight on that Dunkirk enabled, the history of the entire world since 1940 would have been very different. And we tend to see 1940 in chunks, you know, fall of France, Battle of Britain. But if you take it as a whole, Dunkirk and the Battle of France are absolutely integral to what goes on later in 1940, and of course Britain's willingness to fight. And because Britain decides to fight, and by July Hitler's issuing a, you know, last call for reason, he calls it, even those who were in favour of appeasement before the Second World War in the War Cabinet, members like Lord Halifax, are saying, no, we fight on. And that's what Dunkirk does. It gives the forces of freedom, if you will, if that's not too grand, the willingness to fight on until the bitter end. And once that's done, the die ultimately is cast. Churchill's right. Hitler is going to lose the war, and Dunkirk is absolutely fundamental for that.
Well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our debate tonight. My thanks to Professor Eunan O'Halpin of Trinity College Dublin, Dr. David Jordan of King's College London and the Freeman Air and Space Institute, and Professor Jonathan Fennell of King's College London. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, and also Peter Molloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.